The Terrifying Lies Podcast, with music and stories by Craig Nybo. Greetings and welcome back to the Terrifying Lies Podcast. I have a big announcement to make today, and I hope I can fuel your interest. I've told you about the musical I've been composing for a few years. It's called Tesla v. Cthulhu. Well, the time has come. I'm planning to launch the Kickstarter for this project next Tuesday, the 7th of June, 2022. I'd be honored if you'd consider backing the project. At the lowest backing tier, you can get a digital download of the soundtrack for a great deal. The higher backer tiers include autographed CDs, CDs from my back catalog, a t-shirt, and more. Currently, no plans exist to produce the musical either on the stage or as a movie. But if the Kickstarter does well, I would absolutely consider going that direction. To set the stage, I offer this. Lights in the Sky, the official report. The year, 1899. The place, Pikes Peak, Colorado Springs, USA. Nikola Tesla stops at nothing as he conducts experiments to create wireless power in his Colorado Springs lab. Funded by New York billionaire J.P. Morgan, he feels the pressure to convert the Earth itself into a conductor and send power through the air. Tesla, in his own words, explains his objectives in Colorado Springs. First, to ascertain the best conditions for transmitting power without wires. Second, to develop apparatus for the transmission of messages across the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. And third, to work on another problem, which involves a still greater mastery of electrical forces. Nikola Tesla. Hot off the press, Tesla receives messages from outer space. World speaks to world with mysterious signals through vast space. Tesla, the electrician, says he received a message from Mars. The San Francisco Examiner, January 4th, 1901. Nikola Tesla has had the first call of a century from a neighboring planet. He's communicated with Mars, he declares, while on Pikes Peak, delving into the mysteries of the wireless transmission of electrical energy. The summons was faint, but according to Tesla, not to be mistaken. A new voice from a planet millions of miles removed was spoken over one of the myriad of unwired telephones of the universe. And there, near the lonely mountain peak, in the fathomless calm of night, the voice at last found a listener, and world spoke to world in language strange at first, but sure to be clear, says Tesla, ere the 20th century has finished its course. As I think over it now, it seems to me that only a man absolutely stricken with blindness, insensible to the greatness of nature, can hold that this planet is the only one inhabited by intelligent beings. One of the planets in the solar system may be ahead of us in the evolution. Their means of interplanetary communication may be perfect, but we have yet to learn their sign language. It is impossible even at present even to suggest a code on my observations to the Red Cross Society on New Year's Eve were purely speculative. But for the purposes of illustration, they will answer the purpose at present. It is enough to say at this time that a message from Mars, which might be a triangle to them, would appear as some other form to us and vice versa. These differences can only be reconciled by time and careful study. It is wonderful enough, is it not, that a beginning has been made? Nikola Tesla. Could this message be coming from Mars, or perhaps from somewhere else? Far more distant, far more sinister, weird sisters, alleged kidnappers. The Colorado Springs Gazette, March 11th, 1899. Colorado Springs Chief of Police Arlo Schick gave no comment regarding the arrest and release of Jerusha, Gabriella, and Ursula Verkaik, three reclusive sisters who have been living on the outskirts of town since early last year. The disappearance of 15-year-old Strand de Glace has residents wondering, could the three newcomers to town have had something to do with the boys' disappearance?
We brought in the sisters as a precaution, said Chief Schick. They were not under arrest, We're doing everything we can to clear as many leads as possible regarding the DeGlass missing persons case.
Nikola Tesla's right-hand man walks out. He's had enough. The Colorado Springs Gazette, July 9th, 1899. Witnesses spotted Fritz Lowenstein, right-hand man to Colorado Springs' resident genius, Nikola Tesla, at the Carronade Tavern, located on Main Street, City Center. Some described Lowenstein as incensed as he outlined a litany of abusive behavior disseminated by his boss while working at the Knob Hill Laboratory. In the face of these allegations, Lowenstein told friends that he had walked out on Tesla, unable to tolerate the behind-closed-door maltreatment. Witnesses speak of demonic light in the sky. Colorado Springs Gazette, July 10, 1899. At least a score witnesses recounted strange lights in the sky above the woods located west of Colorado Springs.
First there was a kind of sparkly pulse, said Michael Simmons, local farmer. Then something shot up into the clouds like a harpoon of lightning. Everything exploded. I had to look away for a second or I think I would have gone blind.
Witnesses experienced a deafening explosion and light bright enough to leave sunburns, even though the explosion of light happened at about 11:26 p.m., long after dark. Work resumes on Pike's Peak as scientist and assistant reconcile. The Colorado Gazette, July 15th, 1899. It seems all is copacetic on Knob Hill as Nikola Tesla, resident genius, returns to work on his mysterious experiments. Fritz Lowenstein, Tesla's head assistant, formerly witnessed in town declaring his intention to leave the lab, alleging abuses from his employer, seems to have had a change of heart. The two gentlemen return to work on the morning of July 14th. Local residents can expect the usual lightning strikes to emit from Tesla's Knob Hill laboratory. But what really happened? Three mysterious women come to Colorado Springs. The talk of the town in their dark clothes, flicking the evil eye at anyone foolish enough to stare. Dissonance between the world's premier scientist and his right-hand man. An alarming message flowing from outer space. A maelstrom of lights in the sky, followed by Tesla and a few of his friends returning to Colorado Springs, disheveled, with buttoned-down lips. Curious minds want to know what happened in Colorado Springs on that fateful night in 1899. You can only get the answer by listening to the new musical, Tesla v. Cthulhu. To learn more, go to craignibo.com or find the project on Kickstarter, launching on Tuesday, June 7, 2022, at 10 o'clock a.m. Mountain Time. Today I'm going to give you part one of a story called Old Hicks. I took a different tack on this one. A while ago, someone hired me to record her mindfulness podcast here in the studio. She rolled up to the microphone and put down a series of relaxing meditations. They began with a series of exercises to slow down the breathing and relax the body. She then delivers reassuring messages of hope and self-reflection. She wraps up her recordings with instructions to gently awake from a relaxed state and go on with your day. Her recordings inspired me to make a series of horror-based meditations. I thought it might be both cool and hilarious to use similar induction and reentry techniques to bring the body to a relaxed state. But rather than present a series of awareness affirmations, I would drop you smack down in the middle of a horror story. Thus, hypno-nightmares found their genesis. I've written and recorded a series of six hypno-nightmares. I write them in second person, choose your own adventure style, to get you right into the action. I've only released these hypno nightmares to a few people who are kind enough to back the Kickstarters. Even now, I'm not going to bother with the induction and reentry parts of the recordings. Rather, I'll put you right into the story. If you want to pick up the full recordings, you can get them on my website. You can either purchase the digital downloads or the digital downloads plus autographed CDs. Just visit craignibo.com for details. With no further stalling, welcome to your first Hypno Nightmare. Old Hicks, a Hypno Nightmare, written and read by Craig Nibo. Part 1. Dr. Walter Jackson Freeman II stands at the head of his first patient's bed. You look down at him from the balcony of the institution's medical theater. Wrapped,
like every other member of the staff employed at the Hickory Hills Institution for the Insane, better known as Old Hicks. You blame complaints from some of the orderlies for Edgar Raymond's being put under the knife. You feel that a less invasive approach could be found to help him come back from his combat stress reaction. Who could blame Mr. Raymond, patient 14, for lashing out as if he still fought in the jungles of Bataan, side by side with the Filipino forces against the Japs? One day, Raymond had told you how he had been forced to march 62 miles before his body gave out and he collapsed to the side of the trail. A Japanese soldier had bashed his head in with the butt of his rifle and left him for dead. A local man, a father of three, found him and took him home. At great personal sacrifice, the Filipino family nursed him back to health and sent him to America, a broken man. Since coming to Old Hicks, Edgar Raymond mostly refused to eat, reducing him to a skeleton with skin. His aggressiveness, shouting Japanese racial slurs and attacking the staff, caused the administration often to order him restrained. You have sympathy for the man. Not yet 25, Edgar Raymond at least deserves the prospect of living a normal life. But his constant unruly conduct placed him on the table in front of Dr. Walter Freeman, a man determined to alter human behavior with his brain invasive surgery. You can't agree with such a permanent solution, but as a nurse and a woman, you can't possibly voice your opinion to the administration. And so there you stand on the balcony, watching Dr. Freeman prep to perform another of his breakthrough frontal lobotomies.
My hand, thus extended, illustrates the direction of the fibers from the thalamus to the frontal lobe.
Dr. Freeman extends his hand for all to see, thumb away from fingers.
My watch represents the thalamus. My fingers represent the direction of nerve tissue to various parts of the brain. It is possible to sever the fibers to the frontal lobe with lateral and medial cuts.
He raises his right hand, karate chop style, and lays it across the fingers of his left hand to demonstrate the surgical procedure. Dr. Freeman looks down at Edgar Raymond. Only two surgical instruments rest on a steel tray beside him. A long, narrow prod that resembles an ice pick and a wooden mallet that could have been purchased at the corner hardware store. Dr. Freeman continues,
as you can see, little preparation is required to perform the transorbital lobotomy. The patient is awake and alert. I can perform the operation with any anesthetic, but I prefer electroshock.
Dr. Freeman picks up an electrode bonnet from a roll-in electroshock system next to the table and wraps it around Edgar's head, fastening the belt securely with a buckle in the front.
We apply the electrodes and issue the first shock.
Dr. Freeman clicks on the transformer. Edgar Raymond shakes from head to toe under a wash of hot current. Dr. Freeman turns off the electroshock unit. Edgar continues to shake.
Convulsions last about 40 seconds. As the patient shows signs of regaining consciousness, we administer a second shock.
Just as Edgar seems to come out of his seizure, Dr. Freeman issues another wave of current. Edgar dives into another convulsion.
Usually three consecutive convulsions are necessary, but in the old or infirm, a single convulsion should suffice.
After sending Edgar into a third fit of convulsions, Dr. Freeman picks up the ice pick from its steel tray and leans over his patient.
After the convulsion subsides, I lift the upper eyelid, insert the orbital clasp into the conjunctival sac, and align the instrument at parallel with the edge of the nose.
Dr. Freeman inserts the ice pick into Edgar's eye socket, circumventing the eyeball. You wince as you imagine the tip of this instrument scratching the back of the eye socket. Dr. Freeman raises the wooden mallet.
With a sharp tap of the surgical mallet, I drive a point through the orbital plate to a depth of 5 centimeters.
Raymond's head jerks under impact.
By swinging the handle laterally, I sever the greater complex of fibers.
With a sweeping motion, Dr. Freeman swings the ice pick around, slicing through tissue deeper in Edgar's head.
I then return the orbital clasp once again to its position parallel with the ridge of the nose and drive it 2 centimeters inward.
With a single tap, Dr. Freeman drives the instrument deeper into Raymond's skull.
I steady the patient's head, then move the instrument about 20 degrees medially and 30 degrees laterally.
He rotates the ice pick, slicing through more nerve tissue.
At this point, I elevate the head of the instrument, often fracturing the orbital plate. Finally, I return the orbital clasp to its original position and withdraw the instrument.
Dr. Freeman removes the ice pick from Edgar's socket and holds it up for his audience's inspection.
You will notice that the instrument is clean. The procedure can be performed in minutes on up to dozens of patients a day with little hassle. I will now perform the procedure on Mr. Raymond's other eye.
Dr. Freeman goes back to work, driving the ice pick into Edgar's other eye socket. As he performs the procedure, you feel the looming threat of the chicken salad sandwich you ate for lunch coming back up. But surprisingly, you can't look away. Dr. Freeman continues his lecture as he works.
Amazingly, in post-operation, you will see no visible damage, although patients may have a black eye for a few days. Patient 14, Mr. Edgar Raymond, a war hero, I understand, will awaken within 2 hours, bereft of his condition of extreme combat fatigue. He will live a more peaceful existence. Even better, you will find that his tendency toward violent outbursts has vanished, and he will, in the future, be a much more docile patient with which to deal.
Dr. Freeman looks up at you and smiles, a little too flirty for your tastes. You keep a stern expression, but your cheeks blanch, something that you hate about yourself.
My understanding is that we have 4 more patients yet to treat. The entire series of procedures will take less than an hour, and you and your patients can go back to your routines at this fine institution. Next patient, please.
You watch Dr. Freeman perform 3 more lobotomies. As you glance at the others assembled in the theater, you notice that you're not the only one disturbed by Dr. Freeman's brutal yet impassive nature in handling his patients. A pair of orderlies wheels in the last of Dr. Freeman's subjects, patient 18, Zara Yates. More than a couple of the small audience gasp. Rose Singleton, who runs the institution's state-of-the-art closed-circuit security system of his own design, retreats a tentative step as he takes in Zara's almost skeletal visage. Some of the staff feels that patient 18 exudes a kind of metaphysical effect on those around her. Of late, the administration over old Hicks has been forced to isolate her more and more, not because of her behavior, but because of the behavior of patients in rooms adjacent to hers. She and the other 4 patients under Walter Freeman's ice pick all come from the east wing of the institution, a ward reserved for the most high-risk residents. Since her arrival in the east wing, those roomed adjacent to her have displayed increased aggression. It shames you to admit that if Dr. Walter Freeman can subdue her odd effect on others, maybe there is credence to his prefrontal lobotomy procedure. After finishing his operation on Zara Yates, Dr. Freeman holds up his hand in an odd celebratory gesture. His audience applauds. You join them. Directly after the surgeries, the old Hicks administrators host a meet and greet with Dr. Walter Freeman in the lobby of the institution. Orderlies have set up tables. Caterers have brought in food and drinks. The lobby appears to be almost elegant, concealing the fact that the place exists in a constant state of lockdown, armed with automatic emergency magnetic locks in case of a breakout. Due to the criminal nature of its patients, old Hicks is more prison than hospital. You dip a glass of punch from a bowl centering one of the tables and pick up a mini sandwich. When you turn around, Dr. Freeman stands right in front of you, wearing a smile that shudders your nerves.
"I didn't catch your name,"
he asks, extending his hand. You juggle your glass and sandwich until you can shake. You give him your name and issue the most sincere smile you can manage.
"Are you a nurse here at Hickory Hills?"
Dr. Freeman asks.
"Well, if the funny hat doesn't give it away," you say, glancing up at the nurse's cap on your head.
Dr. Freeman chuckles.
"You know, my tour does not relent. I'm off to my next demonstration immediately. However,"
Dr. Freeman puts a hand on your arm. You resist the urge to gasp at his boldness.
"I could be persuaded to stay here another night and push back my business schedule.
You jerk your arm away at his touch. I don't think that's a good idea. Dr. Freeman's expression falls into a dour pan. Well then, he says, I'm not exactly certain what I hope to accomplish spending my time with a nurse. I should be focusing my attention on those who are qualified to perform my procedure. Good day, miss. He walks away, headed for the most senior-ranked administrator in the room. As you watch the shortish man waddle away, you smile, shake your head, and eat your mini sandwich, washing it down with a glass of better-than-expected red punch. One of the incandescent light fixtures above you buzzes as you finish mixing the medication you intend to take to the East Wing patients. You make a note to tell the janitor to change the bulb. You've learned to appreciate the silence of the graveyard shift. After Dr. Freeman departs that evening, many of the staff elect an informal night off. Most go home, leaving an East Wing skeleton crew at Old Hicks that includes you, Roe Singleton, the boy genius security system administrator, and Marcus Quills, the creepiest of Old Hicks's orderlies. Brandon Nagley, one of your favorite security guards, also sticks around. With your cart loaded, you push out of the secured pharmacy into the dimly lit hallway. Barry Schriever, one of the new administrators, a bright-eyed young man with progressive ideas, has instituted new policies that affect hospital lighting. After 10:30 every evening, he orders the staff to reduce hall lighting and fixtures in common areas by 40%. He also contracted light switches to be installed in the patients' rooms, giving them control in their own environments. Schriever derives his policies from research he conducted while writing his thesis at McLean Hospital in Massachusetts. To you, the reduction in light does nothing but up Old Hicks's already significant creep factor. You push your med cart to the barred gate that blocks off the east wing. You draw a ring of keys from your smock pocket and unlock the gate. You push the cart into the wing and close the gate behind you. All five of the patients who went under Dr. Freeman's ice pick live in the East Wing. You're interested to see if Freeman's claim that the prefrontal lobotomy turns problematic patients into docile tenants. The five patients reside in adjacent rooms, either next to each other or across the hall. Perhaps of the five, you most fear Cyrus Glines, patient 17. He's a lifer. After a prolonged trial, he was convicted of repeated rape and murder. But upon close psychiatric scrutiny, he was found to be missing the burden of a conscience. The judge found him non-culpable of his crimes for reasons of insanity and sentenced him to life in the care of psychological professionals. Old Hicks picked him up, and here he's remained for almost 5 years. Never have you been allowed in his room, even with an orderly. You roll your cart up to Cyrus's room and look through the small, barred window set at eye level in the steel door. Can't see into his room with the lights off. Damn Barry Schriever and his light therapy protocols. Cyrus, are you awake? You ask through the opening. You hear him breathing. I'm going to place your medication in the dispenser for you. I need to watch you take it, then I'll leave you alone. You pull open the two-way sliding dispenser seated in the steel door. You pick up a small cup of four pills and pour them into the dispenser. You push the dispenser closed. You expect him to get up from his cot and take the pills. Everything remains silent, except for the sound of his deep breathing. Cyrus, you need to take your medication. Otherwise, I'm going to have to turn on the lights and get Marcus. Part of Barry Schriever's lighting policy includes a rule to never turn on a patient's lights without asking permission, giving them every chance to concede before overriding their room switch. You wait another minute. Cyrus, you wait another few seconds. Cyrus doesn't respond. This is unusual behavior for a man who usually slings a series of inappropriate comments your way. Tell you what, I'm going to place the rest of the patients' medication into their dispensers. I'll wait to turn on your lights until everyone has taken their pills. If you haven't complied by then, it's lights on. You push away from Cyrus Glines' room towards Zara Yates, patient 18's door. Just as you reach the center of the corridor, all five of the med trays with the five lobotomy patients slide open in unsettling unison. you glance at each of the eye-level barred windows in the five still doors. You only see darkness. How could all five of these patients have coordinated such an act as sliding their trays out in unison? You heard no communication, no countdown, no signal of any kind. Keeping your eye on the barred windows, you pick up the remaining four mini-cups of medication and move over to the first tray, set in Jameson Fennell's, patient 15's, door. You place the medication in the shallow drawer and wait a moment for it to slide back into Jameson's room. When it doesn't move, you push the drawer. It won't budge. Jameson must be standing inside the door, holding the drawer in place. You back away and, one by one, place medication in the other three patients' dispensers. You attempt each time to push the drawers back into the patients' rooms, but are met with resistance each time. "Okay, that's enough," you say, backing to the center of the corridor, the furthest distance you can make from the patients' rooms. "The joke's over. I need you to take your medication or it's going to be lights on for all of you." Several silent seconds pass. "That's it. I'm turning on the lights." You push your med cart toward the head of the wing where a bank of light switches is arrayed in a closed control panel. Just as you reach for the catch, all of the med trays slide into the patients' rooms in synchronicity. An inky pool of cool fear flows into your bloodstream. "Okay, good. Now I need you to take your medication." Another moment of silence passes as you wait for the telltale sounds of running water, of swallows, and verbal indications that the East Wing patients have taken their pills. Usually, medication time is more like chumming the waters than force-feeding. Old Hicks is one of the few places where residents are under orders to remain buzzing for most of their waking hours. "Do I need to turn on your room lights?" "I will if you don't comply." All five of the room lights snap on. All five patients stand with their faces inches from the barred windows of their steel doors. All five patients stare at you. The cool ink of fear spreads throughout your system. Your knees threaten to give out. You hold tight to the handle of your med cart to stay on your feet. You look each of the patients in the eye. None of them smile. None of them frown. They just stare at you with stoic effect. You want more than anything to get out of the East Wing. You pull the med cart to the barred exit. Four of the five patients, Cyrus Glines, patient 17, Rebecca Petty, patient 16, Jameson Fennell, patient 15, and the war hero Edgar Raymond, patient 14, retreat into their rooms. Patient 18, Zara Yates, remains, standing just inside her door, her eyes locked on you. You stare into those eyes, deeper than you ever have. She's always had a sort of hypnotic effect on you and other members of the staff. But this time, something even more profound looms behind those eyes. Zara Yates peels her mouth into a smile, revealing crooked, rotting teeth. You back up against the gate. In absolute sync, all patients except Zara Yates turn off their lights. Zara keeps her eyes on you for another moment, then retreats into her room. Her lights flick off.
"Something wrong?"
Man's voice breaks the silence behind you. You gasp, startled, and wheel around to see Marcus Quills, all uniformed up in his white shirt and pants. The embroidered name patch on his left breast reads Marcus, accented with a small yellow smiley face button that you've always found a bit disturbing. Marcus works his usual routine of crawling over your body with his eyes. At this point, you don't care. You just want out. "Unlock the door," you say, momentarily forgetting that you too have a set of keys. Marcus draws a ring from his pocket and unlocks the gate. He swings it wide and lets you through, his eyes flicking down to your legs as you pass by. "Why are you here?" you ask.
"Just doing my rounds. Security checks, you know. Somebody has to put the kids to bed."
Marcus moves through the open gate and shuts it behind him. "Well," you hesitate. You don't enjoy talking to Marcus, but he has to know that something isn't right. "Be careful. Something's different about these patients." Marcus chuckles as he locks the gate.
Is Shriver's lights out policy getting to you?
Just stay on your toes.
Oh, I will.
Marcus says, backing into the corridor with his arms extended in an expressive gesture.
I always stay on my toes.
You roll your eyes, not knowing at all what he means. Probably some kind of unseemly innuendo that flies right by you. You shoot Marcus a tight smile, then push your med cart away from the east wing. As you return the med cart to the pharmacy, think back on Marcus's unconventional appearance in the east wing. You wonder about Marcus's intentions for visiting the east wing patients. A year ago, the institution's human resources department suspended him for 3 months for groping a non-responsive female patient. You've always wondered why the administration hired him back on after such an act. You've made it your duty to keep an eye on him ever since. You decide to stop in at Roe Singleton's science fiction-scaled security room and tell him to keep an extra eye on Marcus Quills. When you enter Roe's sanctum, you're greeted with the same heat and ozone that must be a part of Roe's entire existence. In an effort to cool the place, the boy Wonder has gathered every type of fan he can and placed them around the room, especially near a long table of soldered black and white television tubes. Most of the televisions are off, their black faces staring at you from their positions in a rank of tombstone electronics that you will never understand. Rose sits at a smaller table away from the bank of monitors, chessboard spread over Lazy Susan in front of him. Occasionally, he looks up from an enormous book, moves a chess piece, and rotates the board around to change sides. Monroe, you say, startled, he looks up from his book. Have you patched one of your television sets into Rebecca Petty's room? Roe stands up from his chessboard, accidentally knocking the table with his knees and sending some of the pieces toppling over. He doesn't seem to notice his ruined game as he gambles toward the row of television sets.
They're like people. They have to work in shifts or they get too hot and burn out, he says.
He switches one of the dead sets on with a twist of a large dial. A white horizontal line appears in the center of the screen as the set warms up. The line expands until you can see a blurry image of Rebecca Petty's room. You can't make out much detail, but it is clear that there are two people in the room. Can you make the image more clear? You ask.
Well, that's funny,
Rose says, leaning forward to wipe the screen with the sleeve of his gray dress shirt. His efforts offer no improvement.
That camera was just working fine. Someone must have monkeyed with the lens.
He flips on a few more of the television sets, revealing the interiors of more patients' rooms, including Zara Yates, Cyrus Glines, Jameson Fennell, and Edgar Raymond. Even with the lights off in their rooms, you can make out the patients in their beds. However, in Rebecca Petty's room, even with the lights on, you can't make out what's happening. You see blurred out motion around the bed, as if someone dressed in white stands next to the bedside and someone else lies on the mattress.
Oh, that pervert,
you say.
What pervert?
Roe asks.
I passed Marcus Quills on my way out of the East Wing. He said he was on rounds. I think he's up to his old debased tricks again.
Rebecca Petty, except for a few violent outlashes, spends most of her time in a comatose state. The perfect target for a handsy pervert like Marcus Quills. Only Marcus doesn't know that Rebecca had participated in the East Wing patients' little game of flicking lights and sliding med dispensers earlier that night.
I can't clear up the picture from here,
Roe says, trying to wipe the screen with his sleeve again.
Call Brandon.
I'm going after that bastard, you say, wheeling around to leave Roe's house of ozone. Just as you reach the door, Roe calls your name. You turn to see something new in Rebecca Petty's room. A struggle breaks out between the two blurry people, probably a vicious one, judging by the gyrations and flailing limbs. There's no audio, so you can't hear who's on top of the situation.
Well, that's odd,
Rose says, pointing at the screen patched into Zara Yates' room. Zara stands against the wall, putting as much of her body against the surface as possible, hands splayed out, one ear against the plaster.
What's she doing?
Roe asks. You glance at Rebecca Petty's monitor. One of the beings has overpowered the other. The dominant fighter holds a bedsheet around the other's throat, twisted into a makeshift garrot.
Get security down there now,
you say as you run out of Roe's office and head at full sprint toward the east wing. This has been Old Hicks, a hypno-nightmare written and read by Craig Nybo, Part 1. Today's song follows along the hypnotic nightmare theme. Occasionally, I and my brothers get together to do something we call album in a day. We meet for breakfast. One of us comes up with a theme for the album. We get the theme at the end of the meal. The goal? Compose a song that adheres to the theme in time for a listening party that very night. The Pond came from one of our albums in a day, although I have cleaned up the version you're about to hear and put it on an album called Beautiful Words. I used samples from an old movie called Dementia 13. I hope you like it.
Poor Billy. No wonder you used to get all those nightmares.
Used to? I still get them.
What are they like? Are they terrible?
I don't know.
They're more strange than terrible. I'm always a little boy, and I'm in my room. It's late. I hear somebody outside making a kind of a scraping sound. I get out of bed, look out of the window, and there's a man climbing up the wall, coming closer toward my window. I yell for my mother, and she comes into the room just as the man is coming in through the window. I hold onto her leg, crying. I'm so small, I only come up to her waist. The man is in the shadow. You can almost recognize him, but not really. He says that he's insane, and that someone else in the room is insane also, and that he's going to nod his head, and when he does, that other insane person will nod their head. He nods, and I look up at my mother, and she's nodding her head. And then she starts laughing at me, and she picks me up in her arms, runs outside, and throws me into the pond. Where did you go? I don't know. Come on, let's go.
Call, babe. You wouldn't begrudge an aging man his moment's rest, would you? You know, I think you know the answer to all the problems your family's been having. Because, Billy, you saw your little sister drown all those years ago.
No, I didn't.
Oh, yes, you did. You know how I know you did?
No.
Yes, you told me.
I did not.
Come, babe. Come on, drink up. Do you remember all those years ago when you couldn't sleep? Do you remember who it was gave you the little pill that made you sleep? Remember the dreams? Faces in the shadow? The man climbing up the wall? I haven't forgotten. Consider your mind as a bird in your hand. When it's relaxed, it lies quiet and easy. But when it's tense, it's fun. Strains to leave. Simple principle, isn't it?
You're engaged to treat my body, not my mind.
You're trying to separate that which nature has joined. What I'm trying to say is this, that every year at this time, you work yourself toward a point of hysteria. You remember, worry you imagine, and then you collapse. I just can't believe that such a punctual cycle is physiological.
Aside from all this, am I well?
Aside from all this? Oh, yes. What I want you to do is to rest and to relax your mind. Remember the bird in your hand?
This has been the Terrifying Lies Podcast. Please come again. You're welcome here.